Hello, and welcome back to The Kicker. I'm your host, Josh Hirsch. Last week, CNN reported on a secret prison camp in the Negev Desert, where Palestinian prisoners picked up in Gaza were being held in brutal conditions. The abusive treatment there may have come as a surprise to some, but not to readers of Hagar Shazaf. She's a journalist at the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, who first reported on the prison last December. For the past 5 years, Shazaf has been Haaretz's West Bank correspondent, and she's no stranger to stories about the mistreatment of Palestinians by the Israeli government or civilians. She's also covered the rise in violence by West Bank Palestinians as well. Shazaf, who's currently doing a 3-month fellowship at the Reuters Institute in Oxford, is my guest today, along with her colleague Omer Ben-Jacob, an investigative reporter who covers disinformation, cybercrime, and Israeli influence operations. They have some thoughts about how their country is wading through the tense current moment, but they're mainly here to talk about what it's like to do journalism in Israel right now. Since the Hamas attacks of October 7th, much of the Israeli public has rallied around the government and its ongoing war in Gaza. That's left papers like Haaretz as a bit of an outlier. It's both one of the most respected papers in the country, but also one that's willing to do the kind of direct criticism of the government and its treatment of Palestinians that not many Israelis want to hear. Omer and Hagar, thank you both so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
A pleasure.
Why don't we start, if you don't mind, with a little primer on Haaretz, the paper where you both work. Could you give just a little introduction to what this paper is and where it fits in the Israeli political landscape?
Sure, I'll get us rolling. So I think Haaretz is unique in that it's a kind of mainstream legacy newspaper. It's over 100 years old. It's still family owned by the original family who founded it. And within Israel, Haaretz plays a kind of unique role because on the one hand, as like newspapers like or outlets like Reuters will describe us as left-leaning, but by the same token, we're also very kind of generally held in very high esteem and considered the only kind of non-tabloid or last-standing legit newspaper in Israel. And I think the kind of important thing to know if you're not really well versed in Israeli politics and certainly or Israeli media politics is that it's kind of the only one that actually covers defense issues in a very critical way or in a critical light, not necessarily towing kind of the more mainstream narrative. Agal, did I do us justice? Was that a good description?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting and it's maybe a theme we'll come back to later in this conversation, but there is sort of the American perception of a paper like Haaretz, which I would guess a lot of American Jews think of as like the New York Times. But to some extent, I think it's more marginalized within Israeli society than that, right?
It's not an extremely popular newspaper, but I think it is actually very influential and actually quite well read. I think the issue is that like the New York Times and a lot of kind of respected legacy media outlets, it is also demonized and also politicized and has also been pulled obviously into kind of, you know, info wars at different levels. Mm. Just, I think people in the States assume it's much more popular than what it is, I think, to be honest. I think like it's much more popular among American liberals, I think, in that sense, like it's more well known, I would say, perhaps.
If I can just add, I think another aspect is Haaretz being almost the only subscription-based newspaper in Israel, which naturally, makes the readership a bit smaller, and it also has an English edition, which I think plays a very important role in it being influential in Israel, but also in the U.S. and in circles that are, you know, interested and are in influential position towards Israel.
Yeah. So the other thing that strikes me reading it is that it's just a very direct paper and it does very serious and investigative kind of work. Hagar, I've been sort of looking back at some of your work. You've covered the West Bank now for several years for the paper. And I was just looking at some of the headlines just from last year, some from before and some from after October 7th. I want to read a couple of them. This is about primarily the settlers and the sort of IDF's role in the way that they treat Palestinians who live in the West Bank. You had one that's titled Cigarette Burns, beatings, attempted sexual assault, settlers and soldiers abused Palestinians. There's war, blood is boiling, settlers force Palestinians out of their West Bank homes, and Israeli settlers killing Palestinians, a history of impunity, which is a very strong piece looking at how the investigations that have been opened into some of these cases so often seem to go nowhere. I wonder, as we get into this conversation, I wonder, Hagar, could you give us just a little primer on what's been going on in the West Bank over the last few years?
Yes, so I think in general, the situation in the West Bank has been deteriorating even before the 7th of October. I think that if we look a couple of years back, you had the Trump presidency, which affected the situation in the West Bank very much because everything that has to do with settler construction and Israeli government support for the construction was just, skyrocketing because there was no pushback at all from the U.S. The pushback that was before that and that there is today is not that much as well, but, you suddenly didn't have any of that. Mm-hmm. There also, I think over the past 2 years, the level of violence in the West Bank has also increased very much. It had, again, to do with, I think, just the normalization of the Israeli occupation in the West Bank, the fact that there is no law enforcement system or effective law enforcement system towards Israeli Jews and towards soldiers in the West Bank. So you had, you have like a regular, you have like violent events towards Palestinians regularly, and no one is being held to account. And therefore, things have naturally, I think, deteriorated. Another thing that happened is that Palestinian violence towards settlers and soldiers increased as well. It has to do with the availability of weapons, which is a general problem in Israel.
We have a crazy minister handing out guns.
Yeah, it actually started even before that. So there are a lot more weapon in Israel, and there's a lot more weapon in the West Bank that Palestinians are getting through, smuggling, et cetera. And settlers have quite a lot of weapon too. So you see that all accumulating to the situation that is happening right now in the West Bank, where violence is in really, really crazy levels.
Yeah, I've seen people call it the other war. Which seems like it's just an ongoing conflict.
I want to just say something about that kind of general, I think it's a really interesting kind of moment in time to have this conversation because from Haaretz's perspective, and this really touches to motivations, as an Israeli newspaper, we're very well situated in this reality. And for a long time, we've been trying to hold our country and our democracy to a higher standard. And there's many processes that I think have been going on for many years that have eroded from actual the Israeli democracy to kind of things that Gal was talking about, to kind of, this endless kind of normalization of the occupation. And even within Israeli society, the tolerance of this kind of stuff has, in a sense, grown. And I think Haaretz has been really we're kind of motivated by hold your own society accountable. And I think what's been so crazy and tough or weird over the past kind of 6-7 months, post the war, is that on the one hand, it's a lot of things that are happening are things that we've seen, and there's a wider process that explains this stuff that we as a newspaper could say oh my god, we've been warning people that this could happen, we've been warning about all this stuff, and the politicization of the army and the general kind of the unstableness of the situation in Gaza and so on and so forth. On the other hand, post October 7th, all these things take on a different kind of thing. When you say, for example, the other war, right? From our perspective, it's almost there's this almost kind of long-term kind of project of trying to hold our country you know, responsible and accountable and make sure that it's a country that is governed by law. But on the other hand, post October 7th, things have escalated and actually become a real war to a point where it changes and changes the focus. I don't know if that's clear, if the point was clear.
I totally agree with Omer. Obviously, part of like my motivation is to hold the institutions accountable and to make sure that whoever needs to do their job does their job. But I think that when talking about the West Bank and the ongoing occupation, the institutions themselves are problematic. I don't think, you know, when we were talking about, let's say, I don't know, like law enforcement inside Israel, I can talk about, you know, what works, what doesn't work, what policy or whatever. When I speak about the West Bank and the Israeli police in the West Bank, the whole way in which it is, you know, established and works, and the whole way in it, you know, this the whole concept of it is to maintain the occupation. Therefore, you know, I think that as a journalist, it's also challenging because there's always the question of, you know, is it about making these institutions better? I don't think so, right? It's about, in many ways, kind of trying to, you know, working for a better political situation altogether.
In a way, are you saying basically the issue of... I mean, we face this in the U.S. at times, particularly at times of war, too, right? But I think like there's one thing to go to a government agency as a journalist and hold them accountable to their own standards, you know, which is a form of accountability journalist, and say, you know, here's what you are supposed to do by your own rules, by your own laws, by your own, you know, statement of principles, and here's where you're not living up to it. But then when the statement of principles itself becomes sort of morally questionable, it's a different kind of journalism because you're having to say, is this ethical? What's taking place? It's all legal or it's all above board, but is it what should be happening? Is that the distinction you're drawing?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think I never thought about it this way, but I totally agree with this distinction. And I think, again, when it comes to the West Bank, for example, you know, the law for Israeli settlers and for Palestinians in the West Bank is not the same law. Therefore, you know, I mean, obviously, I am working to, you know, hold institutions accountable to, you know, their own standards. But at the same time, the standards themselves are so, you know, are just unjust. So
I think I just to jump on that, like, I think it's and then what happens is then the newspaper or the actual coverage becomes politicized, because if the position you're chasing is an ethical position that says we as you know, like, just coming off from like humanistic values and liberal values, and like you want to live in a democracy in which human rights and civil rights are just respected, even if that's not necessarily the official policy of certain bodies, right? But then the moment you do that and you're doing that as an ethical position, it becomes very easy, I think, to politicize you and to say it's not that they're just, you know, it's not just about, because we see this as an erosion of democracy, even though it might be legal, it's still an erosion of democracy. And I think that's a dilemma that people in the States can fully probably identify with. Like, there is a question how you don't go necessarily to two-sidedness, but rather say, no, like, this is actually a threat on democracy regardless of my politics, just because this literally undermines democracy, or this is a non-democratic kind of, you know, project.
Right. And the challenge that it introduces, and I want to get into this, is what kind of connection you have with the public, you know, both the people who are loyal readers, but then the broader public who might check in and out of your content. And so I do want to ask, you know, looking at the pre-October 7 period, really for both of you, although Hagar, maybe for you first, what was the freedom you had to do this kind of journalism? What kind of pushback did you find yourself getting?
So I think in my experience, and I actually... thinking about this only now when you're asking this, I think pre-October 7, the reaction was mostly a lack of reaction and lack of interest and sort of like, you know, just ignoring. Because I think the West Bank and the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the occupation, you know, for a long time, I think that for the broad audience, I'm not talking about Haaretz readers, because I think Haaretz readers, by the way, one of the things that they self-identify through is reading Haaretz, which is kind of the only outlet that covers the Israeli occupation. So I think that for Haaretz readers, there is no ignoring there. But for the broader public, I think that mostly, yes, just ignoring the situation, which also means ignoring, you know, the reporting that is being, you know, done around it. Obviously, like, you know, when I would get reactions, I would get very nasty reactions, but nothing in comparison to what happened after October 7th, which to me, from ignoring, it became, you know, just getting very aggressive, at times violent in the, you know, not physically, but like through threats for my work. And I think maybe it had to do with the fact that people could no longer ignore. And therefore, when confronted, that was the reaction.
And Omer, you had a similar kind of situation, right? I mean, you did very tough reporting on spyware in Israel and influence campaigns that the country was doing. I mean, very unflattering coverage, frankly. Did you find that it was received negatively, or was it kind of ignored also in the pre-October 7 period? Or
from my perspective, Agala does work that is actually dangerous, and I write about how information landscape is kind of being polluted and abused for different perspectives, but by different forces. Among them, like the Israeli government and Israeli kind of people that I've reported on that actually sell disinformation as a service. And also, I've written about Israel being targeted by foreign influence campaigns and being the victim of that. But I think the underlying common denominator here is that we live in a world in which, like, the media itself is part of the battle. We now live in a world in which, like, every media, every headline is an object that you either deny or amplify, depending on your politics. And I think what's been so rough post October 7th, from my perspective, is like, if I say, for example, that Israel is buying influence online, so they're not pushing fake news, but they are using fake accounts to push true stuff out, for example, UN reports about sexual violence, and just kind of inorganically amplify facts, then my very reporting on that now will be used by, you know, quote unquote, both sides, but mostly one side, to say that everything Israel does is fake news, no questions asked.
And you've had that experience.
Yes, that's a true story. Yeah, I've written about these kind of post October 7th influence efforts that Israel has made to counter, by the way, equally inorganic and much more nefarious, I would say, disinformation efforts, right? And the Israel's attempt to respond to that and my reporting about that, you know, in a sense, almost kind of makes the problem more severe. On the other hand, it's also an important story.
And to some extent, what I'm thinking back on actually is the fact, Hagar, as you mentioned earlier, that you were one of, if not the only, paper regularly covering events in the West Bank. And to some extent in Israel, it seems like it's not just how you cover things, it's the choice to cover things that has become politicized. And that envelops really every decision you make. Do we write this or don't we, is a conversation you have to have, even if you end up in the right place in the end.
Right. And like, I will, if I'll go back to one of my stories that you mentioned, the one about that the headline has like a cigarette burns. It's a story about a very difficult and very, you know, brutal, I would say, attack that Palestinian activists and residents of a certain community, as well as Israeli activists, endured from settlers and Israeli soldiers post October 7th. And I mean, when I first heard this story, and, you know, I started like collecting testimonies and, you know, all sorts of evidence that I had, and I had quite a lot of evidence, I really never questioned, you know, publishing it, because it was clear to me, you know, that it's an important story. The fact that, you know, after like the Israeli army also confirmed to me, you know, which unit was involved in it, and, you know, that following, I issued obviously a request for comment, and they opened a criminal investigation and dismissed soldiers, et cetera, et cetera. So it was very clear to me that it's an important story. I never thought of not publishing it. And then the day we published it, I got so much backlash. And the main actually type of backlash that I got was, this is not the time to publish these things. Oh, you need to support your people. You know, and this is Twitter talk, right? Like not people that I necessarily even know, but I got emails and I got actually text messages, and I mean, it was a whole story, but I mean, I kind of felt like that was the most dominant sentiment of like, this is a war. You know, you are Israeli, therefore you are at war with Palestinians, and it's not the time to, you know, report a story about soldiers, you know, attacking. And again, brutal attack that had also, you know, we had photos and we had testimonies, we had, you know, confirmation from the army about like certain things. I mean, so I think that I actually never thought about it before publishing. Then after I got that backlash, I suddenly realized, you know, I thought to myself, huh, like that's kind of strange that I never thought of the timing being so incredibly sensitive. Yeah. Like it never occurred to me.
Had you thought of it, would you have done anything differently?
No. Definitely not. But I think I would have prepared myself a bit more because, following that story, like I got a Twitter attacked and, you know, all these sort of things. But my number was also like,
doxxed, like far right groups.
Yeah, and I got, you know, like phone calls with like sexual threats, violent threats, etc. And then after a while, they actually managed to block my WhatsApp account, which in Israel, like that's kind of how we communicate. So, I mean, okay, none of these things are like that bad. I mean, you know, journalists are facing similar things all of the time, but to be honest, I just never expected that because I was so used to what I described before, like being ignored. Right. And then suddenly when there was a reaction and such a like, it was like a violent reaction, right? I was like really surprised by that.
You've both begun to answer this question, but how would you characterize the state of press freedom in Israel in post October 7 time?
I think for us as Israeli citizens and Jews, I feel I live in a society that has press freedom. I think there's a lot of self-censorship and a lot of kind of patriotism that sits on a much wider kind of many issues that we've seen play over the past 20 years, like the same way you have Fox and you have these kind of things. So maybe a small interesting example is that like the Israeli army actually does not fully control, like even if it gets really good press within Israel, it doesn't actually fully control the narrative about the army because tons of Israelis are active on Telegram. And part of the reason Israelis are active on Telegram, where there's this kind of free flow of information, including at some extent from Gaza or certainly from maybe soldiers in Gaza, has to do with the fact that Netanyahu has actually been instrumental in pushing people away from kind of mainstream media and onto these kind of alternative kind of, you know, more closed, what we would call kind of groups or channels. And I think what's so interesting about the war is that like within the Israeli experience, like we don't actually live in a censored society, even though there is a military censorship and military secrets, like in stories about military stuff do go through a military censor who can censor certain things for national security reasons. Like generally the censorship that is going on doesn't really work that well. And the issue is, from at least from my perspective, like patriotism and this assumption that the media should be helping kind of win the war effort. Like that's actually for me, I think the bigger issue, at least within the Jewish Hebrew speaking media.
You're describing in a way more pushback from unofficial spaces than official spaces.
Yeah, from my perspective, I think so. Agal maybe thinks otherwise.
Yeah, so I think it's complicated. I mean, I totally agree. I think that like the biggest issue of Israeli press is self-censorship. And self-censorship not only in the individual reporter sense, but rather like, because, you know, a lot of the mainstream media in Israel is commercial. And I think it is seen as not good for profits to publish and run critical stories, let alone stories that have to do with, you know, Palestinians, either in the West Bank or Gaza. Then there is definitely self-censorship that has to do, I think, like Twitter and social media having actually like a chilling effect on journalists, just again, like the levels of hate that you encounter for any non-mainstream opinion that you you know, that you share, or any non-patriotic, I think, reporting that you do. I think, by the way, that there was like a short time frame there in October 7th, because the military and because the government failed so miserably. I think there was like a time there when, you know, Israeli press was very critical.
I remember, by the way, like some very, very good investigations about how the intelligence apparatus failed and people asleep at the wheel, essentially. I mean, there was a spate of those stories in the early
right days. And we'll see more of them, I think. But in Hebrew we say silence shooting, which means like, you know, when there's war, when there's shooting, obviously, you know, everyone stay silent, don't criticize. It's like a saying, and I think that we have that in every war. But in this war, I kind of feel that it's even more, you know, people are being accused of treason, and by politicians as well, which is another thing that I think, Omer, like you kind of said, it's more from like patriotic public. But I think we have, you know, a very, very extreme right-wing government, very, very populist, and they keep bashing the few critical reporters, or even the not very critical reporters that we have, on their Twitter accounts, on whatever, in speeches that they make, et cetera, et cetera. And this has become worse, I think, over the course of, you know, the term of this government. And since October 7th, yes, even worse, definitely.
I think an interesting example now would be Al Jazeera. Like, we've seen this kind of logic, government logic peak with the government attempting now to actually kind of ban Al Jazeera in Israel, which is, again, like Gal can testify, this is like is actually an old story. So this is a repeat kind of thing that they've done, and like issues with Al Jazeera reporting or their financial motivation or whatever notwithstanding, like there's something obviously extremely problematic about that, about like the government going so openly against, like, you know, a media outlet, like as biased as it may be.
And most Israeli reporters saying nothing about it.
Exactly. And I think generally that enjoying mainstream support. Yeah.
I mean, that's also part of, I think, a trend of Palestinian reporters and Arab reporters working in Israel that are definitely being silenced and are definitely, you know, we see attacks on Palestinian Arab reporters inside Israel. We see that from, you know, the police, and we see that from like random people. And, you know, it was difficult to be a Palestinian reporter in Israel, not to mention West Bank and Gaza, obviously, which is, you know, a totally different and much, much worse situation. But talking about inside Israel now, it was difficult even before October 7th. But now, you know, I don't see how it will not make the daily reality of all Arabic-speaking reporters and media in Israel worse.
There's a term you used, Omer, to describe Hagar's work as dangerous. And I've now heard, Hagar, you make a reference to attacks on Twitter and getting doxxed. I don't want to pass by that. How literal is that? I mean, has it been actually dangerous, or has it felt dangerous?
So, I mean, I have to say that I feel very obviously privileged from, you know, I am an Israeli Jewish reporter, which makes my work much, much safer than that of my Palestinian colleagues. Obviously in Gaza, which, you know, we are not, that's not the focus of our conversation, I think, but I mean, goes without saying, right? That being a journalist, there is obviously the most dangerous, you know, place to be a journalist in.
I think the deadliest conflict for journalists in a very long time.
And even if I'm talking about the West Bank, I mean, the, you know, level of threats and violence that I'm facing are really nothing in comparison to my Palestinian colleagues. I mean, and it has to do with like a number of things. I mean, first of all, you know, I'm a Jewish woman, which means I'm speaking Hebrew, which, you know, just on a very basic level, I'm able to communicate with the army and I'm able to communicate with settlers who really, really, some of which really, really hate me and might see me, you know, as, you know, the enemy or, you know, at least an aid to the enemy. But still, I mean, it's nothing in comparison to what a Palestinian journalist will be facing. And also, you know, just my colleagues who are like covering military raids on refugee camps and, you know, Palestinian cities, et cetera. I mean, you know, so I'm not saying that it's just like a lip service. I just think that like a thing that becomes very apparent to you when you are working in the West Bank is the really kind of separate, very, very different experiences that a Jewish person and a Palestinian person has in each and every aspect of life, right? And it also goes, I mean, it's also including the work of a journalist. You know, I'll just share, I mean, it's not a physical danger thing, but I'll just share something that happened to me a couple of weeks ago. I was in the West Bank in the village of Douma. And I did a story about the army blocking, you know, roads leading to Palestinian villages. Then, like 2 weeks later, I basically got a text message from a settler that I know who told me, "Huh, I heard that you were in the area the other day." And I was like, "No, I was not." And then he was like, "Really? Are you sure? Weren't you at the entrance to Douma on that and that date?" I can't remember what date it was. And I was like, "Yeah, I actually was. How do you know that?" And he's like, "I have sources."
What was the implicit message of this person telling you?
I don't know. I don't think that it was like a threat. I didn't see that as a threat, but it was just, you know.
We see you
kind of thing. And yeah, and again, like we also know you. And, you know, when you're around, someone will tell us. And I mean, not even really nearby, but like I was in the area at the entrance to a Palestinian village.
Yeah. What do you think the American diaspora or the British diaspora, for that matter, doesn't understand about the situation in Israel right now?
Wow, that's a really, really, really good question. One I've been like obsessing about for a long time. I think there's two different things happening now that are really interesting. One, I think there's a huge just like psychological gap. Like it's surprising like how much people don't understand like how traumatized Israeli society is. Like we are actually being exposed to massive amounts of psychological warfare that is turning out to be extremely effective. Like I see it on myself,
and it was a horrifying day, right? Like we don't need to pass by that. It was a horrifying day.
I'll even say something else. I think one of the biggest kind of tragedies in my reporting space that have emerged post October 7th is for some reason people on both sides think that denying either like the massacre on October 7th or the fact that's like 30 plus thousand people have been killed in Gaza are somehow mutually exclusive, and that you need to deny one side if to be able to support the other side. And I think that's, we've never seen that happen at such a scale. The other thing, which to me is also very, very important, is that like because we feel, or the mainstream Israeli society feels, this widespread denialism, it plugs into a real experience of like, I think, we are actually under attack. And again, I'm not justifying that. I'm just saying at a psychological and political level, like Israeli society has not found a way to kind of feel that it's being, you know, that its trauma is recognized. And I think that the debate around Zionism and Israel's right to kind of exist at a fund level has very much scared Israelis and does resonate on an October 7th level. Agal, did I make sense?
I mean, you did, and I will say that I disagree. While obviously, I think the denialism is a very important issue, and I definitely agree with the fact that, you know, people don't have or shouldn't deny you know, what happened in October 7th. And I actually, to be honest, saw people that I appreciate or if appreciated, and people who I even considered friends, engage in some form of denialism of what happened on October 7th. And I was deeply disappointed by that. Just on a journalistic, because some of these people are journalists, like on a journalistic level, I was also, you know, disappointed, not to mention the, like, a human level. That being said, I'm not sure that had denialism not existed, the Israeli public's reaction toward what's happening in Gaza and how it sees what sort of reaction should be done or not would have been different.
I agree with you, but I think the level of kind of international left wing, from our perspective, kind of motivation around, for example, like, you know, the attack on the New York Times in the regard of like the sexual reporting, like the motivations behind that were even like, or, you know, are difficult even for people like me and you to reconcile, and do feed into kind of a broader kind of sense that, yes, we're very much kind of alone and no one will believe us even when something terrible happens. And not that says anything about what happened after that, right? But I think in that sense, you're right. It doesn't mean that Israeli side would probably be out, you know, in droves to stop the attacks in Gaza now, but I do think it feeds into something that every Israeli did feel, and I think that's a big issue.
Yeah, totally. But what I'm saying is, I don't think it would have made, like, you know, the Israeli audience, the Israeli public, opinion about the war and you know, about the revenge that I think Israeli public for sure thought, that still thinks to some extent, that Gazans deserved after that. I don't think it would have made it any difference. So you made the connection there, and I just wanted to, you know, because I don't think that this connection really exists.
Yeah,
you know, to return a little bit tangentially to the press question, one of the things that I'm thinking while you guys are talking, and Omar, you mentioned trauma. You have this sort of question in the media of whose trauma do we depict and whose trauma do we validate in doing so? And in some ways, that's sort of the fundamental question. How much space does any given publication give to legitimizing the Israeli traumatic experience and also legitimizing and demonstrating the Palestinian traumatic experience? And if there's not room for one or the other, then you end up with a very lopsided depiction of things.
I think that the point that that is interesting to take in terms of, like, for example, like this trauma, almost trauma gauging, right? Like, how much place is allocated by each kind of type of outlet to the coverage? Even that as a broader question to me is problematic. Like, I would accept a reality in which there are, like, right-wing papers that cover Israeli trauma. There are left-wing papers that will, you know, perhaps like focus on Palestinians more. That would also be true internationally, but we accept this kind of plurality of positions. The moment it becomes like navel-gazing, like media criticism at a hyped level, then that to me becomes part of the kind of, you know, political reality in a sense. And then I think that starts to undermine the ability to kind of actually address the issues that created the trauma. And like, if you go back to look at you know, I think many different kind of conflicts were covered using kind of, you know, different aspects of trauma storytelling, from Ukraine and to, like, you know, ISIS, mm-hmm. on, you know, attacks on different communities in Syria and so on. And I think that's also, like, it's also okay that there's a plurality of these stories. And I think what's so concerning for me is this kind of, again, this exclusivity of trauma, this exclusivity of facts, this idea that everything needs to be like serve a narrative. I think it's a problem internally in Israel, and I think it's a problem externally for Israel and Palestine and people who are in the long term invested in our well-being.
I totally agree. Yeah, I think it's going back to like the wider problem of denialism, I think, in of both sides. I mean, how can you deny the fact that like both people have their share of trauma?
Yeah, and then that facilitates Israelis like just ignoring what's happening in Gaza, right? Because the denialism is not always even active, right? It can be a passive. It's an entire worldview that both sides can kind of engage in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's the question, by the way, I think that as journalists, we are very tempted to think that, you know, if only people knew, then maybe their opinion would be different or they would take this and this into account. And I do have to say, I'm not entirely convinced by that, because I think Israelis actually are aware, for example, about what's happening in Gaza. Yeah. I think that as journalists, we sometimes romanticize, you know, the power of the press.
So why keep going?
Because we want to live here. I have the most simplest answer. Like, I think it's like incumbent on people to have a responsibility towards their community and where they live. And I think if we live here, regardless of our like philosophical positions on the, you know, the idea of the state of Israel, either way, like, I think you have a responsibility to kind of stay and try to do what you can. And it's also okay that we can't save the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think first of all, you know, we do influence, to some extent, policy. You know, I know that the Israeli military knows that, you know, when I report on something, then, you know, it comes to light. And, you know, people know about what happened. And I think it matters, right? It matters just in the fact, in the sense of like, they know someone is watching. Second of all, yes, I think that as Haaretz, and it's a very unpopular thing to say in Israel, but I think the fact that we reach a global audience helps, I think, you know, put pressure on a certain policy issues.
You can't save the world, yeah, but you can make it better.
Yeah. And on that note, thank you to both of you for taking the time out of doing that kind of work to come talk to us.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
The Kicker is brought to you by the Columbia Journalism Review and produced by Amanda Dara. I'm your host, Josh Hirsch.